Welcome, everyone, to the Theory and Method panel. So we've got Anthony is walking around with a microphone. So first come, first serve.
I have a general question for the panel. For those who are praxeologists, praxeology, to my understanding, presupposes that things are axiomatically true. So by arguing arguing that things like the minimum wage are inefficient, that they produce certain outcomes, doesn't that necessitate accepting the premise that things aren't axiomatically true and that you have to prove them to be?
Well, the question, when you say you start with the action axiom, but it certainly wouldn't be the case that everything else is axiomatic. Also, the notion of proof is basic to praxeology, so it isn't at all in contradiction to praxeology that you would have to have a proof that the interventionist measure wouldn't work. I don't see what the difficulty is supposed to be.
Is that microphone on?
Not if I can help it. Oh.
So now you have to say it all again.
Oh, well, I just said that in...
the microphone. No, I mean it.
Well, I don't know if it's axiomatic, but it's a fact that that would be very bad for my digestion if I did that. In praxeology, the action axiom is an axiom, but it certainly isn't the case that everything else is an axiom. The notion of proof is basic to praxeology. So in order to show that an interventionist measure was inefficient, you would certainly have to have a proof. That doesn't at all contradict the claim that there are certain statements that are known, such as the action axiom, that are known axiomatically. I'm not seeing why you would have thought otherwise, but please don't tell us why.
Yeah, so this is a question for Dr. Gordon. I actually already got an answer from Dr. Sloaner earlier, but I wanted everybody to hear it. So Hans Sherman Hoppe, obviously he's presented a lot of different ideas like you talked about in your lecture, but a lot of his critics aren't very nice about it. They call him a fascist, they call him a statist, a collectivist. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because of the ideas themselves and people just see them the wrong way, or do you think it's because of how he presents them?
I would be inclined to think neither of those things. It's just that aside from views that we have in Austrian economics and libertarian theory, people have views on various social issues of some more of a conservative or left-wing nature. And Hans is quite conservative in his social values. So I think many people who don't like that tend to have a negative view of him. I think it's quite unfair to him. They accuse him of all sorts of things that he hasn't done.
So this question is primarily for Dr. Gordon, but please feel free to step in. Regarding method, do you think that Austrian economics is kind of linked to Gadamer's hermeneutics and phenomenology in that we need to find a method for it and to use kind of as a method and a truth even for our science?
I don't think that praxeology would be linked to Gadamer's truth and method, because you remember in that book, as you go from the title, he's contrasting truth with method. So he says method presupposes some sort of non-theoretical understanding before we can have method. So I would say that's certainly not part of praxeology. And I would think you should read on that. There's an essay by Rothbard called Hermeneutics versus Austrian Economics. As you might suspect from the title, it isn't entirely favorable to hermeneutics.
So for Professor Terrell, I remember your talk, your lecture about the education issue in America, and I was thinking, what could be other alternatives to solve this problem? I know that there are some people who are trying to found universities, new universities, but I don't think this is enough, especially given that the market itself is very intervened. So I was wondering if you knew about other solutions.
I would suggest you save that question for the next panel. Professor Terrell will be on the next panel.
So my question is for Professor Klein, but everyone can join. What would be the relationship between Austrian economics and complexity theory, like the Brian Arthur variant? And what should Austrian economics try to do to connect with that approach? How can Austrians help complexity theory? Are there some improvements that can be made in the relationship between these approaches?
Yeah, I'm actually going to defer to other panelists if they have comments. I personally don't see much of a connection between Austrian economics and complexity theory. I mean, Brian Arthur's work on industry evolution, you know, is very interesting. I think some of his ideas on path dependence I think we can use them in doing historical analysis of technology paths and so forth, but I don't really see a connection between complexity theory per se and Austrian economics, but maybe someone else does or has thought about it or written about it. Yeah, we need simpler questions than complex ones. As an aside, I assume the reason you're asking the question is because some people have tried to draw those connections and said that some of the analytical methods, for example, that are used to model industry evolution might also be relevant for understanding, you know, might be more sort of Austrian in spirit compared to equilibrium-based approaches. So I guess we could say that Brian Arthur and some of his colleagues, like the Santa Fe crowd, and most Austrian economists have some common criticisms or compatible criticisms of the sort of the way modern equilibrium economics is done. But beyond that, I'm not sure that there are many direct links.
So I was told to ask which panel to ask this question to. So if this applies, I would love an answer. If not, I'll save it for the next one. Murray Rothbard in the primitivism essay that Mark Thornton opened up with in his lecture today starts out with the basic fact that all humans are different, they are unique, and then you have all these extrapolations that you can draw from it. And then another Austrian, Erich von Knoll-Ladin, in his book Liberty or Equality, goes through each different kind of equality that one could have and says, being as humans are different, equality is bad. And he also critiques equality of law. And I believe he cites the proverb, it is oppressive for the ox and the lion to be under the same law. So is there an Austrian way to derive equality under the law, or would the Austrian method lead one to assume that equality under the law is unnatural or artificial? Or is that from the next panel?
Yeah, I was I was just referring to the basic inequality of the law, and I was just referring to some general systems that we talk about or live in. And obviously, even the basic, there is actually no basic equality in actual law, in actual legal processes. It's just the intent of the American system of law. So I wouldn't read a whole lot about that with respect to my lecture, but I'm not sure I can comment on Eric Lindeen.
My question is for Dr. Salerno. Guido Holzman, in his book on Mises, talks about how Wieser sort of won out over von Bawerk in the Austrian Academy in the early 19th century, early 20th century. And he kind of talks about how that was sort of negative, sort of net negative on the Austrian school and set the school back for several years. Can you describe the differences between Wieser and von Bawerk? It sort of wasn't clear to me.
First of all, Wieser didn't win out over von Bawerk. Von Bawerk went to work for the government of Austria in 1890 or so. And so he wasn't around when Menger was forced, because of a scandal, which we won't talk about, to give up his chair at the University of Vienna. And Wieser was there, so Wieser got the chair. Von Bawerk came back 2 years later, 1905, and then he was given, they came up with another chair that he was given. But Wieser was the teacher in that crucial period from 1899 to 1903 of the fourth generation of Austrians, Hayek, Machlup, Hobbler, Morgenstern. And Wieser was very, very Walrasian. Okay, he believed in sort of mathematical equilibrium, though he expounded it in a very verbal way. So in addition, even though von Bawerk had come back and was teaching, and was teaching a very famous seminar, Wieser's also, and von Bawerk as well, upheld Schumpeter as being one of their brightest students, even though they both thought he was wrongheaded. And they sort of gave short shrift to Mises. So von Bawerk was even more Walrasian. Schumpeter was even more Walrasian, more mathematically inclined, though he himself didn't do mathematical economics. So to make a long story short, he had written a book on methodology in 1907, I think, or 1908, and then he wrote his very famous book in 1911. Am I right there, David? Yeah. And anyway, he had international fame by then. So when the fourth generation came to be in the university, Hayek and so on, they all read the books of, so they were in the university about 1919, so both of Schumpeter's books were out. So they read those books. They were heavily influenced by Wieser, heavily influenced by Schumpeter's work, and that's why, and tragically, von Bawerk died in 1914, before they even came into the university. So it was almost by a tragic accident, and also the fact that Mises didn't get a chair in the university, that they were really under the influence of sort of another strand of the tradition that tended to be much more equilibrium.
This is just for anyone who wants to answer it. Can any amount of empirical evidence ever outweigh praxeological theory?
I think we see those two ways of knowing as complements, not substitutes, right? I mean, it depends on the question that's being asked. So if the question is about a historical phenomenon or something that happened yesterday, right? I mean, theory guides are, how we pose the question. We look to empirical data to sort of understand magnitudes and figure out in history what factor was more important than what other factor, but we're guided by deductive theory, praxeological theory, in how we interpret that evidence, how we arrive at an understanding of a specific event. So we can derive general theoretical principles without regard for empirical evidence, as that term is commonly understood, but that doesn't allow us to answer specific historical questions. So we wouldn't really pose the question that way, that the two are sort of placed in opposition to each other.
Okay. I would also say that there could be cases, and have been notable cases, where we'd worked out the profession or the vocation, had worked out certain theoretical structures, and then because of empirical events, they revisited the development, the step-by-step process by which they'd reached this theoretical condition, because it didn't seem consistent enough with the actual evidence. They couldn't quite reconcile the two. So a famous recent example is Joe Salerno's article on reformulating the Austrian business cycle theory. Well, what's the subtext in light of the financial crisis or something like this, right? So I think that I'm not sure that that's what you were referring to, but there are cases where that sort of give and take can occur from the empirical world to the theory. But as Dr. Klein has already mentioned, in the end, the two are always consistent, right? Or we always perceive them as being consistent.
I was wondering if the panel could elaborate the difference between Mises' calculation argument and Hayek's knowledge argument. Is it basically what to produce versus how to produce, or is it something different than that?
Yeah. It's what's produced, how it's produced. All of those are all tied up with one question. It's the same. It's all part of the same question, and it's a calculation problem, in the sense that even if Mises granted this much, both in his article and then again in Human Action, that the planner can have all the knowledge, both scientific, could have all the engineers and scientists at his, right there in his office at his fingertips, and he could have all knowledge fed to him of the particular circumstances of time and place, but he still would not be able to calculate the cost of any given production process in a very complex industrial society. So it's he wouldn't know. I think I used the example in my talk. He wouldn't know whether to put a titanium bumper, a fiberglass bumper, or a steel bumper on a car. Okay, he wouldn't know. The other example I used was whether a home, if you live in the Midwest, should be built 670 miles away and then shipped to the site where it's put together. I mean, he just wouldn't have. He wouldn't know the cost of doing that.
Hey, my question's for anyone who wants it. Is it fair to say that the axiom of human action is induced and not deduced?
Well, I think there are different views on that. Certainly, it would if it's an axiom, it wouldn't be deduced. An axiom would mean that it isn't. If it were deduced from something, that would be the axiom rather than what you've got. The induction part would come in if you take a view somewhat like that of Rothbard, or exactly like that of Rothbard. You would hold that we come to understand the action axiom by abstraction from the various actions in the empirical world, that we grasp the necessity that human beings act. Mises didn't look at it that way, but in no case would it be deduced from something else.
I think I'll try and rephrase the question that I asked earlier and see if I could get a different answer. So if we can agree that private property is a prerequisite to life, then arguments over the efficiency of things like minimum wage, which is a restriction on private property, simply don't seem to, well, they seem to buy into the premise that it is an argument over efficiency and not an issue of morality.
Well, I think it's right that the argument against the minimum wage would be one that it wouldn't achieve the end of promoting higher wages while getting full employment. I think that's right, but I'm not getting at all what the connection you have with, you're making with life. I'm not at all seeing what you're getting at. That's not, I'm sure it's my fault, but I'm just not seeing it.
We've heard a lot about different economic systems this week, whether it's capitalism, communism, fascism, or socialism. How do we know when one economic system moves to another? What's the point of no return, essentially?
Rothbard once asked Mises that. When can we say that society has become socialist? And Mises says when the stock market's abolished, when the means of production could no longer be exchanged, because all that the stock market is, it consists of titles to pro rata shares of different firms. So that's one answer. I mean, maybe somebody else has another answer.
If I may, you tagged on at the end, you know, what's the point of no return? There is no, there's never a point of no return, right? I mean, no matter where we are on the spectrum, it's a place I like to live regularly. There's always, you know, humans make choices and can, and through their actions move this, you know, society one way or another. So it's never a point of no return.
Yeah, and you might want to read the book by Henry Hazlitt, Time Will Run Back. That was one of Rothbard's favorite novels, and it shows how a path back from social central planning back to pure laissez-faire capitalism. And it's pretty exciting.
Hi, I have a question. It would be great for Dr. Block if he was here, but how do you handle the privatization of, say, rivers or water reservoirs? How do you handle free-flowing things like that? I was curious if y'all have any thoughts without me having to read the whole book. Thanks.
I think that's more of a policy issue, so why don't you save it for the next panel?
This might not be quite the right panel because it's sort of a question I've been thinking from Dr. Terrell's lecture, but I suppose it still somewhat relates to method. Given some sort of assumption that people would rather consume more energy or consume energy in a more efficient form, is it feasible that you could engage in some level of economic calculation through, you know, he used the BTUs as a unit. Would that be feasible in any sort of way, or if not, why?
I mean, you'd have to exchange things in terms of BTUs of energy. There would have to be a common denominator. There would have to be a general medium of exchange. So it's just like with labor hours. It would be the same problem. Energy isn't the only thing you, BTUs, energy is not the only input, right? So then the energy will be more or less efficient given how many workers and how much land is being combined with it. So I would say it's not really a real possibility.
I just add, in the 1930s, there was a movement called technocracy that was founded by the engineer Howard Scott that proposed to run the economy on that, based on energy calculations.
Uh,
I just forgot my question.
Can you come back to me?
Yeah, so this is a question for Dr. Salerno. If you're not familiar with this, then that's okay if you can't answer it. But Andrew Kleiman wrote the book Reclaiming Marxist Capital, in which he critiques Bombaverk, and he also references the earlier works of Rudolf Hilferding. Now, I won't be able to really summarize their arguments, but one argument that Kleiman gives, for example, is, oh, well, there's no way Marx contradicted himself because he's not possibly that stupid. So if you're familiar with their critiques, what do you think of them?
I'm not familiar with their critiques, but David may be.
Well, I think Kleiman, Hilferding was one of the most important critics of Bombaverk. He was in Bombaverk's seminar. So what he tended to argue was that the subjective theory of value was just kind of a bourgeois theory. It didn't really show the correct influence of, it didn't really, the real factors in the economy were class-based, and that Bombaverk hadn't refuted that. In fact, that Bombaverk's account was rather an ideological cover-up to disguise exploitation in the capitalist economy. I don't think very much of that. I had a short pamphlet called Critics of Marxism, where I mentioned some of those. I didn't discuss Hilferding. Now, the other point you mentioned doesn't seem like a good argument, that maybe Marx was that stupid.
All right, this will have to be the last question.
This one's for Dr. Klein. So what's missing from the Kirchnerian kind of theory of alertness for entrepreneurship, and why does that matter for the, you know, the broader theory of entrepreneurship?
Well, the way I would describe it is Kirchner's theory is almost, it sort of takes the Walrasian model for granted and then layers on top of it the idea that markets are not at any one time, you know, prices are not at their Walrasian equilibrium values, but we can assume that they're sort of trending in that direction, because if they weren't, there would be sort of an arbitrage opportunity and we would expect someone to jump into the market and exploit it. You know, we wouldn't expect $10 bills to be sitting on the sidewalk for very long. There would be a tendency for people systematically to pick them up. I mean, there, you know, several ways to think about sort of problems with that. I mean, in my interpretation, Mises and Rothbard, they reject the Walrasian model of general equilibrium in the first place. So that isn't a state toward which real markets are trending. There's not a tendency to reach those prices anyway, so it's sort of a solution in search of a real problem. But another way to think about it is Kirchner's model abstracts away from what we were talking about the other day, namely uncertainty, right? There's no capital invested by the alert entrepreneur in his model. There's no skin in the game. So it's almost as if, you know, you're walking down the street. If you don't see the $10 bill and you simply walk past it, then you don't earn the $10, but you don't lose anything either, right? What Mises has in mind is more of a model where, you know, you walk down the street and, you know, you see kind of like a little green edge of a piece of paper sticking out from under a rock. It might be a $10 bill, but it might not. In order to find out, you've got to go and buy a $5 shovel, right, and dig out that rock. If you do find a $10 bill, there's $5 left over. You've earned a $5 profit. But if it's just a chewing gum wrapper, then you've earned a $5 loss, right? So what Mises has in mind by entrepreneurship is this sort of arrangement of resources, capital goods, factors of production in pursuit of profit, but always with the prospect of loss. If you look at that little section that was in the pre-readings on profit and loss from Mises, he sort of lays that out very well. So it's not clear that there's anything out there for entrepreneurs to be alert to, right? Kirzner assumes that the $10 bill exists. It's out there waiting for the first person to reach down and grab it. But in Mises' model, profits and losses don't exist prior to action, right? They're brought about by actions of producers and consumers and so forth. They're only realized and only recognizable ex post. So there's no profit opportunity to be alert to ex ante. So that can't be the reason why, that can't be the motive for human action, purposeful human action.
If I can just add one little short story. Many years ago, I was going from the Mises Institute to lunch with Dan Sanchez and Peter St. Ange. And on the ground, there was a nickel. And I picked it up. And from that day forward, I knew all of mainstream economics was incorrect. So thank you, everyone.